Greetings. This is Marek Zabriskie, the rector of Christ Church Greenwich, and I'm joined today by my co-pilot inspiration for this podcast, Andrew Boyer. And our special guest today is the Dean Emeritus of Canterbury Cathedral, Robert Willis, and his partner, Fletcher Banner, who's with us as well. We're so excited to have you here. Robert served as the Dean of Canterbury Cathedral from 2001 to 2022. Prior to that, he had been Dean of the Hereford Cathedral near the Welsh border. And he has served as one of the leading voices in the 85 million member Anglican Communion in 165 countries around the world. He looks like he stepped out of central casting. He's utterly charming, very articulate. Could listen to you speak all day, Robert.
Thank you, Marek.
And you've been a wonderful and insightful advisor to three Archbishops of Canterbury, George Carey, Rowan Williams, and Justin Welby. And we're most interested in learning more about your life as dean, some of the significant accomplishments as you look back on them, and covering a wide variety of topics. But let's begin with Canterbury. You were there as dean for 21 years. As you look back on it, what are some of the most significant contributions you feel like you and the cathedral were able to share during your tenure there?
It's a long memory back to 2001, and having to get to know the cathedral from scratch. I wasn't someone who was aware of Canterbury terribly when I was sent to Canterbury to be dean. So I took my time in thinking how near to Hereford is this, and I mean in terms of atmosphere and ethos. Certain things were absolutely the same. The sense of giving hospitality to all as a cathedral, because there's no parish attached to a cathedral. Anyone who comes owns the place for that moment, and one has to help the staff give the right kind of hospitality when people are there. But at the same time, Canterbury was so different from Hereford because the whole world believes they own Canterbury. And when they come, they've quite often saved up to come from right across the world. So you have to make sure that at any moment the cathedral is ready to receive visitors of all kinds, different languages, and be ready to make them free of the place. I used to think of it a little bit like going into a good bookshop, and you would go in and someone would say, please, you know, look around. And some of the time you would want to browse. At other times you would look up to get some help. And so you'd want your docents and guides to be there. And unless there was a tour planned in that way, then they would just sort of hold back a little bit. But the moment someone looked up, they'd be ready to come forward and just assist. It was a very broad canvas. And I think that one of the things that we're glad we left in place was the rhythm of the Benedictine day. The school would be there as part of the Cathedral Foundation, reminding us that scholarship and study was one of the strands of Benedictine life. But all the people who were working at the stonemasonry and the carpentry and all of that, the medieval glass, were there to show us that physical work was very much part of the Benedictine strand, so body and mind. And then the choir and the worship daily, beautiful worship, which was a privilege to be part of all the time I was there, with fine organists and players and many volunteer choirs coming from across the world. In fact, the very first choir which sang for a week after I was installed was the choir of St. Luke's Darien. Mm. And they came to do a week singing there. It was the first time I'd ever heard of Darien. And now tonight here in Christchurch, Greenwich, Darien,
Connecticut,
Darien's choir is coming.
Right.
So it's a good coincidence here.
I have a question about Canterbury, because, of course, the Archbishop of Canterbury is the head of the Anglican Church, right, and has been forever. Why was Canterbury, you know, of all the cathedrals, why did it become the one that became sort of the focus of the church, as opposed to, you know,
London,
Westminster Abbey, or Winchester.
Okay, it's because of the way in which Christianity came to England for the second time. the Romans, when they occupied the parts of the British Isles, and it was mostly the sort of English part up to Hadrian's Wall, over to Offa's Dyke, when they came, they brought Christianity with them once the empire had been Christianized under Constantine. So there had been a Christian presence, but when they left, then others came in from the east, and that was a pagan occupation. The Christians tended to flee to the Celtic west. And so with the coming of that, with Gregory sending Augustine landed in Kent, the most powerful king of the kingdoms which made up England at that time was Ethelbert of Kent. And so Augustine made his first encampment and set up headquarters there. Gregory did suggest going on to London, but Augustine would have none of it. So Canterbury, it remained. So you actually are very near the coast, it's in a strange place. When I went there, I hardly knew it. I was from the West Country, and it seemed an awful long way to go to Canterbury from there. When I come to the States, a long way means something else than what it was in England. So
I wonder if you recall anyone particularly that you met almost by surprise, maybe a famous person who asked a question, or any chance encounter, maybe someone very not well known. But do you have any meeting that just pops out of your mind?
Well, generally, if we were having famous people, you would get warning. Mm-hmm. And so then you could just study up on what they were. If it was a modern actor who might be coming, the University of Kent in Canterbury would hold degree ceremonies in the nave, and very often they would give an honorary degree to someone who was famous in one way or another, and you always got invited to lunch to those things, and that caused actors, musicians, scientists of all sorts to come. And it was always good to read up on them beforehand so you could have sensible conversations with them and make a contribution. Other times, people would tug your sleeve, and that had happened in various places. And I remember, even as Vicar of Sherborne, meeting Joan Hickson, who played Miss Marple in Agatha Christie things on the television. And I was sure that this lady I knew really well, because I knew her face, and that I'd met her in the week, and I said, "It's so nice to see you. I'm sorry I can't remember your name." And she said, "Well, I'm actually Joan Hicks, and I play Miss Marple, and that's what you're knowing now." So quite often, you know, when you see someone like that, you put your foot right in it by assuming it's somebody else. And Fletcher will be the first to tell you, I'm not very good at recognizing celebs, as you might say. So essentially, they would come up and be introduced to you. But we've used actresses like Joanna Lumley, who's a great friend of ours, and she would be someone who, I think we used her for the reading the narrative of the Road to Emmaus in our garden congregation. But she was always someone who loved Canterbury, and she's well known for the series Absolutely Fabulous in England.
So, what is the most frequent question that you get asked?
A doubt, where did Becket die? You know, where was Becket killed?
Can you talk about that? Because some of our listeners may not know who Becket is.
Yes, okay. Thomas Becket was Archbishop of Canterbury and was originally not a priest, but a layman, and was Lord Chancellor of England, for Chancellor for Henry II, because he was Henry II's best friend. And sometimes your best friends aren't the people you put in places where they're liable to become loyal to something else. Well, he thought what he really wanted was a best friend who was Archbishop of Canterbury and would just do his will, because that would put him in power, not only in the state, but in the church as well. So he made Becket into the Archbishop of Canterbury. But at that point, the integrity of Becket stepped in and became loyal to the church. And when Henry was having fights about the church and royal power, Becket was found to be on the other side. And so they had massive spats and quarrels. And Becket spent some of his time in exile. And then in the year 1170, he came back to spend Christmas at Canterbury. The population greeted him on the shores of Kent with adulation. They loved the Archbishop because they felt he was on their side. And he came to Canterbury. But meanwhile, someone Henry was in Normandy because he was king not only of England at that time, but also of Norman France and much more. And someone said, you know, that Becket had arrived back. And then it's thought, you know, it was well into the meal, so he was fairly lubricated with wine and ale and everything else. And he said something like, you know, will no one rid me of this turbulent priest? And four knights of his, thinking that was the king's command, crossed the Channel, came to Canterbury, and murdered the archbishop there in his own cathedral. And Henry II was horrified, as were the whole of medieval Europe. And so Henry had to do penance and come and kneel in Canterbury and be beaten by monks and goodness knows what. But Becket himself became a saint in record time. And so by 1174, he canonized. And we recently have been to Salamanca, to a church there in Spain, which is the first to be consecrated and dedicated to Thomas Becket, there in Salamanca. So his fame spread. There's one in northern Norway in the same way. So it was medieval Europe just horrified. And so he became a very powerful saint. So he became St. Thomas of Canterbury. And that made Canterbury into a pilgrim site. And pilgrims would come, like the Chaucer pilgrims in Canterbury Tales, mm-hmm. simply to kneel at the site of Becket's shrine at that time. Now, the shrine was destroyed by Henry VIII, but a candle now burns on that site permanently. And there's a great space there between the grave of King Henry IV and of the Black Prince, both of whom had been buried near enough to Becket's shrine that they could hold on to his coattails and get into heaven the easy way. But the shrine is very much there.
Do you still have pilgrims come to Canterbury?
Yes.
Yeah. So is there a trail or how do
yeah,
they...
Yeah, there is. There are several trails, but some come through from the west and some come on the London pilgrim route. But it's not only a trail which lands up in Canterbury, it's also Canterbury a beginning trail which goes to other pilgrim sites. So that the route from Canterbury to Rome is known as the Via Francigena. It's a very long walk, but people do it constantly. I've set people off on bicycles and horseback, and it's just the most amazing thing. But then at the same time, the other routes that go to Santiago can start off there too. You cross the Channel and off you go. And Marek, you're an expert at those routes, so.
I'm thinking of doing the Via Francigena, and it's just a 1,500-mile walk. So
yeah.
It'd be good for working off the Episcopate, that bulge down below my head. Anyway, what was your Thomas Becket moment? What was the most difficult thing you had to tackle or address? And maybe apart from COVID, because I want to talk about the Garden Congregation in just a moment, but was there another moment that was really a real test of
making decisions
right.
with the Archbishop, do you mean? And perhaps the things which stay in mind are the beginning of the Archiepiscopate of Rowan Williams, when Rowan decided that he would come for the whole of Holy Week. And we were going to begin, and this hadn't happened in Canterbury before, the practice of foot washing, which I was used to in the parish, but it hadn't happened in the cathedral. Now, when the Archbishop comes to Canterbury, the Canterbury staff tend to take over from Lambeth, and Lambeth Palace would see that as downtime. And so we're talking Rowan's first year, which was 2003, something like that, I think. He said that he was very happy to do the foot washing. He was used to that as Archbishop of Wales and in his former ministry, very used to that. And then the Lambeth publicity office got in touch and said, no, this must not be photographed. This must not be. It's too risky, all of these things. And I thought, well, that's silly. I mean, it's really a wonderful act of sort of semi-sacramental value, recalling the Last Supper. And so at the time, I didn't hear the Lambeth voice. so to speak. And so the press and photographers were allowed in to film and photograph that in a very sensitive way. But I was nervous about all of this.
What was the fear? I don't quite understand. Like what were they worried about?
I think it was thought that not everyone agreed with this kind of liturgy, which was part of the Holy Week liturgy. There's nothing in the prayer book which talks about foot washing and all of those things.
Pope Francis had the same issue when he, at the beginning of his tenure as Pope, did foot washing and washed the feet of, I think, some prison inmates.
Yeah.
And there was lots of blowback. Yeah. Some people, prominent canon lawyers said this is a very poor example of leadership. But he's doing what Jesus did. Right. I thought it was one of the most beautiful moments.
I would agree.
Right.
And in fact, the next morning on Good Friday, the papers showed all of them the picture of Rowan kneeling on the floor with the foot of a child, or different pictures of the various people we'd chosen for foot washing. And then at that moment, everything became quite clear. You know, the row went away because it then became part of the practice. So the great thing about the Church of England is if you do something once, then the next year you can say, as is our custom, we do, and it's become
the custom.
It only
takes 1 year.
Yeah. Sometimes.
Yes. So let's talk about leadership again, because I think the second time I met you was when I was on a Benedictine experience with Esther Duvall, and we were meeting at Canterbury Cathedral and the close, staying at the lodge, and you gave a magnificent tour of the deanery, talking about the various deans whose portraits hang there, and explain the difference between, using railway terminology, you said what a line layer does and what a station master does. Can you talk about those two roles in terms of what kind of leaders they are, and then how you saw that playing out in your own leadership at the cathedral?
It was an image. I don't know where the image came from. I know I caught it in a, I'm wanting to say Austin Farrer, but I don't think it is Austin Farrer. I think it's someone else who gave that image to me. And as you went round with the various deans and thought, as you, because everyone was there, no one was missing from the very beginning of when Canterbury became a dean in charge instead of the prior. And as you went round, you thought, this person here had the task of settling things. Now, probably the biggest station master in that way, we're talking railway terminology, but either you cut through great swathes of rock in order to lay a railway line to get you somewhere. That's a line layer.
And what kind of person do you need to do that?
You want someone who's perfectly perfectly happy with being buffeted and in the middle of a sort of row about what they're trying to do, and has to believe in cutting through that rock, which has always been there. And so that was one style of leadership. The other style of leadership was being the station master, who, as a Victorian sort of term, who came then to settle things with a waiting room and a ticket office and the trains running on time, and making people feel happy to come and be there as trains ran in the right way. Now, most of the story of huge places like Canterbury and other cathedrals which go on for so long, and other organizations, is that you might have three station masters, but then you might need a line layer again to do things a bit differently. And so the choosing of the character of what the leader was like became important. But as we went round the portraits, that was one thing one could say about folk. You know, this was a radical thinker. The first Dean of Canterbury had been a great Renaissance scholar, Dean Wotton, who had been the ambassador to the Holy Roman Empire and came back to be the Dean of Canterbury. And his, shall we say, station master quality meant that he kept things as far as possible as they were before. There'd been a reformation and the liturgy was changed, but nevertheless, he kept things, the bells rang and worship was said.
When are we talking about?
We're talking in the middle of the 16th century,
I see,
about 1540.
Okay.
And so there he was, and he stayed through the reign, the end of the reign of Henry VIII, the whole of the reign of Edward VI, the whole of the reign of Mary, when things went back to Catholic England, and then the beginning of Elizabeth II. It was quite an act, really, for someone who was active in royal service and also in Canterbury service, but he chose some of the monks from the monastery to be part of his chapter in the new foundation. And that seemed to be a sense of continuity. We had books in the library that had belonged to monks who then were canons and went on. So that was somebody of that sort. But the other thing that you could point out in those portraits was that nearly every country that you were showing the portraits to, if you had seminarians from right across the world, was the fact that most places at some stage or another had a definitive civil war. And quite often it was a civil war fought on religious principles. Certainly the English Civil War in the 17th century was a definitive moment in English history. And at its base, there was a religious quarrel going on between those who were strictly Puritans and those who were on the side of the king, who were more sacramental in the way they wanted things done. And as you well know, in the end, the king lost that war. But 11 years later, his son was brought back because the Puritan regime of Oliver Cromwell was not quite to the English taste in all ways. And so it swung back. But the monarchy would never try the Divine Right of Kings Act again. You know, it actually had been tempered by the fact there'd been a civil war. Now, you had your civil war in the middle of the 19th century. We had ours in the middle of the 17th century. And you'd have Sudanese, for example, seminarians there who had had civil war through the 1950s and until now the Sudan is split in two halves. So you could relate to different nations by saying, look, you may think this place has always been peaceful. You could also show Americans on the morning of 9/11 or the morning after 9/11 when cruise ships were in Dover, and Americans came in enormous distress to Canterbury. And you could show them in the tranquility of the precincts and the peacefulness of the crypt, pictures of Canterbury practically laid waste around the cathedral in the Second World War after the Baedeker raid had just destroyed the city in a fireball, really. But the wind was blowing in a particular direction. So the cathedral itself, they began to bomb the fireball, and the cathedral itself was spared. So the tower was still standing. But you can generally find, with a history as long as Canterbury's, something which says, look, you're going through that now, but we've been through that before, and it does come through, but for the moment, we're standing with you.
Right, it survived during the plague. Not one monk died during the plague because they used the ablutions as they went in and out of worship each day.
Yeah.
The pandemic was kind of that moment for us in our time.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about what you learned about God during the pandemic? What surprised you? What delighted you? And how you and Fletcher got this special service that formed your garden congregation that had people worldwide tune into each day. And I'm going to ask Fletcher to just chime in a little bit about that as well.
Okay, let me just start off and then you'll get a much more accurate picture from Fletcher a bit later on. That meant that the cathedral and the parish churches across England were shut. And so worship had stopped at the very time when people needed to feel that they were being prayed for and were getting words of worship. And so it was Fletcher who said to me on the first morning of the lockdown, March the 25th, the Feast of the Annunciation in 2020, just go into the garden and don't let 1400 years of daily prayer stop, because for a Benedictine foundation, the morning and evening office was a really important aspect. And I'll bring a camera, and he wasn't a skilled cameraman at that time, we'll just sort of see how it goes, because one or two members of the congregation might like to join in as well, because they'll all be in their homes and locked in and not even able to talk to their neighbours next door. So that's how we started, in the garden. And we were blessed with the most beautiful spring. so that it was easy to go into the garden at that time. We didn't know it was going to go on every day for 26 months, this, through winter and snow and goodness, and, you know, all kinds of weathers. But at the same time, we were using Anglican things, the lectionary. We read the Gospels as they were put through. And we were rewarded by the fact that through that summer and autumn, we had the whole of St. Luke and the whole of the Acts of the Apostles to read. That's how the daily reading went. But I, for my part, just said things that I would have said if I was visiting someone in their home, and then just read some psalm and some scripture. But Fletcher was massively more imaginative and saying, look, I'll put you here in the garden. And then we would talk through the night before things. And just as we thought that we'd got, or I thought we'd got into a sort of stability, he'd say, I think we should do this now. And so you were the moving part in this, and saying, oh, let's look at the calendar, or let's look at special dates. Or when we got to the Ukraine war, then that became a completely different thing, because we were able then every morning to have the yellow and blue badge on our lapels. And I remember when all the mimosas were blooming in the garden, bright yellow in the winter. They bloom in January or February, and a bright blue sky behind. Then I was sitting there with a Ukrainian flag done for me behind me, as a great sort of sense of all of that. So it was a surprise how the world tuned in. But I'll let you talk about that rather than, because I'm otherwise going to be...
If Phil and Fletcher, what you recall about that, because you had such a big part in how that turned out, and this became, you moved from having, you know, 100,000 people maybe watching every day to sometimes millions. Can you tell us more about that?
Hi. I think, to be honest, it was the two parts to that question. The first one, how we came to do it. I think that for us, it just seemed a natural continuation, albeit virtual, of the ministry that we'd been doing for the best part of 20 years before that in Canterbury. We, being in Canterbury, were rooted most firmly in the Anglican Episcopal tradition. But we always had to be open to all. And so we ourselves always believed that the gateposts for a spiritual journey, for a faith path of any individual, should be as wide as possible. And so I suppose we brought that to the online worship, and it just seemed a very natural progression. So that allowed many people who perhaps were a surprise, Buddhists in California, and people of the Islamic faith and Jewish faith, tuning in from all over the world, who related with us daily and joined us daily and felt as much a part of our congregation as Episcopal Anglicans or Catholics or any other denomination of the Christian faith. And so I think that it was a surprise very early on, when our intention had been to just communicate with a few members of our own congregation, to bring them some level of comfort and connection. And then suddenly, and it shouldn't have been a surprise really, looking back, and we feel rather silly, but suddenly we were surprised that we were getting letters and emails from people all over the world. And you know, there was an initial sort of, but how do they know about this? And of course, it was on the internet, so of course anybody could know about it. Very, very soon after that, many other people sort of started writing in. Which fueled the ministry that Robert and I were sort of doing through that time as well, which was almost the back end of the virtual connection. So when people were writing in and talking about very real world problems, about their fears, about relationship breakups, about the bereavement, all manner of things that were made so much more intense and so much more painful because of the separation and the isolation that was caused as a result of COVID, which was pretty much the same, more or less at slightly different times, the world over, to all peoples of all faiths and none, that we then believed that because they'd reached to us, we should reach back. So as much as possible, clearly not with everybody, because there just wasn't time to allow that. But if there was a particular letter or a particular email that we believed needed a response to. I hope hard to try and find a telephone number or an email, and then reach out, and then Robert would say prayers with them down the phone, or we'd email back, and that ministry still continues to this day, where we've got people that are only just discovering the morning prayer online worship now, months and months after we've finished. And going through the 26 months, or that have gone through it already and are going back to the beginning and starting again.
So earlier today, we got my mother-in-law on the phone, and she was just like, she had talked to a rock star. She said to me after I put you on the phone, Robert, she said, "Was that really who I think it was?" And you helped her get through, along with millions of people around the world, get through this dark time, this time that seemed like we were facing the plague. What can we learn from this about the role of the church in inspiring and giving people hope? Because there will always be difficult times. What would be the takeaway to carry into the future?
I'd say to start with that we were only doing what you might call regular things in terms of what we were using. We were using a psalmody, a little bit, and the scripture, and then talking about it. But before ever we started, there was a sort of good morning type exercise, and people got used to the rhythm of the sentences we'd use at the beginning. We've not yet mentioned the role of the animals.
Yeah. W.C. Fields said, right, I don't work with animals or children, but that was your secret sauce.
Yes, but we didn't try it, that one. It was the cats that led the way. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, people got to know our pigs and chickens and goodness and turkeys and goodness is what the guinea fowl, that they knew their names. But it was just one of the cats who jumped on the table in the first spring because the bluebells were out. And Leo sat there and I said, we came to the point, we said the Our Father. At the end, he yawned and it looked just like Amen, as we said Amen. And that began things. But later on, he performed the trick of jumping into my cassock and disappearing completely. And that just went viral all over the world, as did Tiger with his dipping the paw in the milk. And we had a cockerel named Russell Crowe. I was reading, and it wasn't Holy Week, but it came round in the ordinary reading of the Gospel of St. Luke, reading the story of Peter's denial. And when we got to the point where it said, "And the cock crowed," the cockerel had actually positioned himself, and we didn't hear the word crowed. He just let this enormous, he was a big cockerel, let this crow that. And people wrote in and said, "How did you train him to do that?" And I thought, you've never kept animals. You can't train them to do anything. You know, this simply happened. But I suppose when you're thinking of 26 months with no day missing, and you've got animals around, you're going to get things like that. And wild birds as well became quite tame because they always knew we'd be there in the garden and things of that kind. And so people just sort of felt they were in a completely different country. I mean, I don't mean nation, but they'd entered into a different country when they entered the garden, where things would just sort of happen, and the animals broke down reserve. And I've known that happen with, well, you know this, so, Marek, when you take the dog out, people will talk to you because they're patting the dog. And it's exactly the same. Sometimes when it was really wet and windy, you would suggest, Fletcher, that we went into the greenhouse and took the turkeys with us. And and the turkeys were sort of walking backwards and forwards as we went on. And I got used to just sort of carrying on with the conversation.
I do think as well we were incredibly lucky that, or were we lucky, or was there a design or a hand in it, that we felt almost on a daily basis that things seemed to go coincidentally very, very much in the way that we wanted them and needed them to go very often. And so I think that Robert touched on the forum earlier, that one person wrote in fairly early and said that I came for the cat but stayed for catechism. And I think that the animals were part of those wide gateposts, that they allowed people to be able to engage. And many people that were joining us had, for whatever reason, had an interrupted faith journey themselves. And so they had had reasons, obstacles, problems that had prevented them from going to their own places of worship. And that's across the faith. It's not just a Christian experience. And I think in the safety and security of their own homes, they were then able to start thinking about their own faith and their own spirituality, engaging with us each day. And that then gave them confidence to go forward, and many of them since, to then re-engage with an active physical form of worship, which for us is always the most important kind of coming together in community, whichever your community might be. But I should probably say as well that as far as the animals were concerned, we were really nervous about the role of animals because we'd never done any religious broadcasting, if you like, and it still seems ridiculous to sort of classify ourselves as that because there are a wonderful professionals out there like your good selves.
Like ourselves.
Who are doing this exactly.
Exactly, you know, I was going to say.
None better.
And this is really, by the way, James Herriot meeting the Anglican Communion. Yeah. All creatures great and small, all things bright and beautiful.
But I think that... we were very acutely aware that we needed to be sensitive to people's reception, and that they were primarily engaging with an act of worship. And so when the first incident, I think it was possibly even Tiger, I don't think it was even Leo, that we had a letter come in the next day, and Robert was quite upset because he felt, and I felt initially, that we had let somebody down, who had said, you know, that you know, this is absolutely outrageous because this is the word of the Lord, and if I was reading the Bible, the animals have got no place being anywhere near there, and so we thought, well, we didn't want to cause harm or effrontery to somebody who was wanting a spiritual engagement. And then we thought about this and we thought, actually, I'm sorry, but we don't believe this. You know, we believe that creation in all of its dexterity and wonderfulness is as much a part of engaging with our Lord as going to church on Sunday and sitting in church. So so we decided that we'd double down. And actually, if the animals came on, then, you know, the animals came on. And so we decided to put that letter aside, not to forget it, but to keep it in mind. Within 3 days, we had dozens of letters from all over the world saying how much they loved the animals, which actually was almost a sort of an affirmation of what we had really visualized ourselves. And so I think that, to answer your question, Marek, I think that that in whatever faith you are engaging with, and whether you have the duty of you and Robert in terms of leading that faith, that you have to trust yourself sometimes and go with your instincts. And sometimes that's risky. Sometimes you get it wrong. But sometimes something really wonderful happens.
The people made us brave. Sorry.
Did you end it? Is it still like...
No, we ended it because we had to leave the deanery.
Yes.
And so we were desperately sad to end it because there were so many people still waiting for that. And this sort of wail of distress went up across the world. There's nothing we could do because... Yeah. I think we realized afterwards there was an intention of let's try something else when we're not there. But what we were doing involved a trio. That was me and Fletcher and the garden. And when we lost the garden...
Which also includes the animals.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But that whole context, because when we left, they were all our animals. And so we had to find good homes, which we did. Aww. For all of them, apart from the cats who came with us. Mm-hmm. But the rest were given to really good people who looked after these. So if the pigs went off to a children's farm in a school. And so
twice the size.
Yeah, they're now twice the size and having their tummies tickled and stuff, yeah. But it was amazing. But I think I could see that if you were in Australia in a blazing midsummer and suddenly there's a scene in an English garden covered in snow with a robin singing, that took on an sort of air of freshness across the world, or vice versa. You could do it with an English summer at a time when the rest of the world might be in the southern hemisphere in winter. And it did give a sense of the world coming together in that, in something that was marvelous. We kept learning lessons.
So earlier we talked, and you were so kind to talk about the faith of Queen Elizabeth II and what that was like.
Yeah.
I wonder if I could switch and just ask you about the faith of King Charles. What is that like?
We have had King Charles at Canterbury on several occasions when he was Prince of Wales. And we admire him hugely because he was right to the fore of caring about the planet long before anyone else was recognizing that what he was trying to teach was going to be crucial for the world. And one thinks of him at the beginning of sort of climate change conferences, and his concern from the Amazon Basin. And so, do you want to talk about that?
I'm not speaking from any specific historical context here, but it's widely thought that actually we have King Charles to thank for COP in itself, because originally there was a desire that he had to try and sort of fix what he could see so badly going wrong with the way that the human beings were interacting with the world, and utilize the draw of the Royal Yacht Britannia to host the first summit, the first COP, with the then president of Brazil, and with a number of other world leaders, representatives in the United States and elsewhere. And all those years ago, he was already championing and doing direct action in trying to make this planet a better place for all of us to enjoy and love and look after.
Robert, I wonder if we could close by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about what's on tap for Fletcher and you in this next stage of life.
Yeah.
And then I want to ask you about a quote that you gave in a sermon in the National Cathedral.
Yeah. Well, at the moment, what we're doing is responding to invitations which had their genesis, I suppose, in the Garden Congregation. And so I'm responding to an invitation you gave me 15 years ago to come and preach where you were then. And so we've done that today. But
we're we're late.
It's a bit late, yes.
Patience. I've always tried to be patient.
But the nice thing is that we have now a week here with two weekends and study sessions through the week. And that gives a bit of stability to our life. We've been traveling around quite a lot. And we're going on to China and Hong Kong Cathedral and places of that sort. But in the end, I think we shall find a regularity and decide when we're at home and when we can be with people. Next year, there are lots of invitations that we've responded to across the world. And this is really something where we're giving back all the affection we got across the airwaves when we were in those 26 months of absolutely being anchored day by day to Canterbury because we couldn't go anywhere. So it was a good thing to break out and come and see the people we only knew online.
And so I want to close with this. In a sermon you preached at the Washington National Cathedral in June, you quoted Catherine of Siena, one of the great saints of the church, and one of the doctors of the Roman Catholic Church. Be who God wants you to be, and you will set the world on fire. Can you say more about that?
I think I was speaking about the particularity of every human being. And I believe that God has given different gifts, and no gift is more precious than another. So that if the gifts that you have, and you discover them as life unfolds, and you suddenly sense that this creative skill and aspect of your life is something that can be exercised. I could tell many stories of parishioners who found that much later in life, and it was it awakened a skill that they didn't even know they had. But what I do believe is that no human being is ever closer to God than when they're being creative. And that creative task is because he's the great creator. And so you feel yourself given a new optimism, a new hope when you're being creative. And that might be body, mind, or spirit, but I think it's vastly important. And when you channel that and think, gosh, yes, this is what I've always thought I ought to be doing, then it might be just an aspect of your life for a bit, and then you'll discover a new one. But the lovely thing is that however far you go on the pilgrim journey of life, there's always a new creativity which will awaken in part of that sort of mystic joining of body, mind, and spirit within the community.
I'm smiling because, Merrick, it sounds like you've basically got him to paraphrase the point of this podcast and the calling. Like, that's exactly it, right? Well done, sir.
What a notion to leave us with, that we're never closer to God than we're most creative.
Yeah.
God bless you. That is a gift that we can all take with us. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you,
Robert,
both. Yeah, thank you.